Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to be here today. To add to your misery, I'm going to show you yet another facet of how we as a society perform very poor management of our resources and of our health system. And so my talk will focus on the uses of antimicrobials outside of the animal feeding realm and veterinary realm. I'm going to look at the overuse of antimicrobial household products and environmental and human health effects. Before I get going, I'd just like to remind you, sometimes it's, you know, we see all these talks and sometimes they don't relate to our life. I can assure you that among us here, several of us will die of multi-drug-resistant infections. Okay? That's a fact. We can do something about it. Now, it turns out that we haven't acted very proactively in the past. We can do this in the future. Another fact is that I'm hailing from Arizona now, but I'm hearing here in Washington, everybody's looking for money. We are spending almost 20% of our gross productive income here for healthcare issues. You've seen in other slides earlier that a drug-resistant infection can cost up to $1 million per patient. We're all going to pay for this. And so if there is a cheap way of making money and saving money, public health is a very good investment in considering better regulations. And by the way, bacteria are intrinsically apolitical. There are no democratic and republican bacteria, and there is no republican or democratic cancer. So we have issues to tackle here, and we have to overcome some initial burdens, but the payoff will be huge. Before I get going, I have to reveal here that during my research on environmental impacts of antimicrobials, I've come about some microorganisms that have the unique capability of actually using them as a carbon and energy source, and filed a patent on this in the hope that maybe these techniques can be used in the future to clean up some of the environments that have been contaminated for about 5 decades now due to overuse of antimicrobials. I'd like to tackle this issue today here by doing a case study of an antimicrobial chemical and look at its life cycle. And then I'm going to show you expanding from this local vision to nationwide data and then tackle some regulatory challenges that we are facing. Here are triclosan and triclocarbon. It's not triclosan. It's not a trick. It's actually a trick that doesn't work, bless you. Triclosan is a trichlorinated sanitation agent, and that's where the name is coming from. These chemicals have been around for quite some time. They are now present in just about every household and every place. Even if you don't buy them, you encounter them here at these meetings, in hotels, at gas stations, everywhere. The chemicals have been around for quite some time, for over 50 years, in some instances, for example, for triclocarbon. So since they have been used for a long time, the assumption is that they are safe and that it's okay what we're doing with them. However, if you look at these chemicals, you notice that they have aromatic rings and that these aromatic rings are carrying halogen atoms like chlorines. This is a chemistry that's very familiar to us because all of the chemicals so far that have been banned and are on the Dirty Dozen list and so forth are halogenated organics. And oftentimes they have these chlorinated ring structures like PCBs. The issue of overuse in antimicrobials in the household is not a recent one. During a period where Republicans and Democrats actually got their act together and thought about public health, it was in the 70s when we created the US EPA and the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. Another chemical was banned that at that point penetrated some 400 household products and personal care products. The chemical was called hexachlorophene. And it was successfully removed at the time. We are awaiting yet similar actions from our indecisive politicians. I got involved in the research on triclosan and triclocarbon after studying dioxins first. And there's a structural similarity between triclosan and dioxin. Actually, triclosan is a pre-dioxin. You can convert it into a toxic dioxin. But while I was looking at triclosan, I discovered this chemical, triclocarbon. And I found that we use about £1 million per year of this chemical in the United States. And back in 2002, there was not a single report of where this chemical might go when we're done using it. We all knew that we flush it down, you know, in the drain. But after that, the fate was unknown. And if you look at the label here, it indicates that that it has some potential liabilities. So hopefully there's a benefit that can outweigh any potential risks. Along the lines, I had to learn that unfortunately there are no benefits to be reported, and all we have are the risks. When I started my research, I looked into different aspects. For example, is the chemical pure? Does it contain carcinogenic impurities? When it degrades, what does it fall apart into? Are these chemicals harmful? Does the chemical persist? Is there cross-resistance? Does it bioaccumulate in humans and biota? And does it cause endocrine disruption? And now 9 years later, we see that the check marks throughout, some are more profound than others. The cross-resistance to antibiotics really is maybe a yes-no, because we still are looking for funding and research to conduct the work on whether triclocarbon also promotes cross-resistance to antibiotics, just as triclosan does. But in analogy, we can assume that it does. But all the other adverse impacts that are shown here already are proven. So what happens to these products that we use on a daily basis? And that probably we're going to encounter in the next 30 minutes when we leave the session. So all the materials are typically washed down in the domestic wastewater and become part of the sewage. The sewage is conveyed to wastewater treatment plants, and they treat the water, and then it becomes surface water or groundwater, and then drinking water again. The chemical also can accumulate in sludge, and then the sludge is being disposed of by application on land, which is good if you want to recycle the nutrients, but you can also recycle toxic chemicals along with that, and we're going to take a look at some numbers of that. And if you apply chemical-laden biosolids on land, then you also can have leaching and impact on groundwater and contamination of drinking water. This is a typical wastewater treatment plant. This one here is the plant in Baltimore near Johns Hopkins University, where I conducted most of the research. And what we did back in 2005 and 2006 was to sample this plant extensively to find out what happens to triclocarbon. And so we took samples at the influent and at the effluent of the plant, and also took a look at the consistency and the quantities and concentrations of triclosan in the biosolids, which is a bit nicer term for digested sewage sludge, which used to be a hazardous waste before we came up with the beautiful word biosolids. When you look at the influent concentrations due to widespread use, we have about 6 parts per billion, that's micrograms per liter, of triclocarbon in influent at wastewater treatment plants. And the plants, although they are not designed to remove these chemicals, do an excellent job, and they remove about 97% of the compound. But you have to remember that only because something has disappeared, it isn't really gone, right? It's a little bit like magic. So what happened here is that we have simply moved the chemical away from the water and into another medium that was available and in which the chemicals could partition, and that is the sewage sludge. And so if the sludge then gets digested, meaning that the chemical was still there after the sludge has been fully treated. And you see here, this is a logarithmic plot, that the concentrations in the digested sludge are about 5 orders of magnitude higher than those in the effluent. And as an engineer, if you know the concentration and if you know the volumetric flow of things, you can do what's called a mass balance. You can figure out what actually happens to, you know, the chemical on average. So as we use the chemical, less than 50% of it is being degraded, and 3% of all the molecules entering the plant exit it in the treated wastewater and go into our surface water. And most of the chemical gets sequestered in the sludge. The sludge gets treated, but the chemical resists the treatment because it's an antimicrobial and it's a highly chlorinated aromatic. So it doesn't get destroyed. And most of the material then ends up in the sewage sludge. What do we do with the sewage sludge? Well, we make a lot of it. It's a train that goes from Phoenix to San Francisco. The train doesn't move, but we fill it up every year with biosolids. So it's a very long train, and it's a lot of material. We have to get rid of it somehow. So what we're doing right now is about half of all the biosolids that are produced are being applied on land for, as we call it, as a fertilizer. But it's really a cheap disposal mechanism. And we can also burn the material. Triclosan is a pre-dioxin, so we can form dioxins that cause cancer. And then part of it gets deposited in landfills, where we have leaching processes, where the leachate is fed back into the wastewater treatment plants. So it can, again, mobilize the antimicrobials. How does all this come together for you folks? So if you go to the supermarket today and you do your monthly or yearly shopping, depending on how big your household is. Let's say you pick up an 8-pack of soap, antimicrobial soap, because that's the only one you see when you go into the store. You have to bend down or be as tall as I am and reach far up to find a product that doesn't contain antimicrobials. So if you pick up the next best pack, you have 8 bars of soap, and after you use them up, they all get flushed down in your drain. And then about 6 of these, the active ingredient of 6 of these soap bars ends up in the sewage sludge. Now, half of the sewage sludge goes to agriculture, right? So remember that next time you go through a soap bar, you know, about the active ingredients of 3 of these soap bars ends up in agriculture. Now, triclocarban and triclosan are registered as agricultural pesticides, but they are not supposed to be used there. And so this is an inadvertent application of these antimicrobials. Triclosan, by the way, has a very similar risk profile as triclocarban. And so you see it causes multiple issues, and principally here, endocrine disruption and cross-resistance to antibiotics causes great concerns. In terms of its behavior in the wastewater treatment plant, we also see that about half of the chemical is degraded, 2% break through the plant, and about half of it is accumulated in the digested sewage sludge. Now, there's only a few percent of the total mass arriving at the plant discharged into surface waters, right? But what happens to those chemicals that make it through the plant and are entering the water environment? We took some sediment core samples in Jamaica Bay and also in Baltimore and analyzed them. And if you think of a plexiglass core that you push into the muck, you know, in an aquatic environment, what you do is you actually get a profile of the chemistry that gets deposited, because things always rain down in the water column. So over time, you have the stratification of things that were used and then deposited, buried, and then the next layer comes. So if you look for radionuclides in these sediments, you can actually date them, and so you can translate a given depth in your column to a year. And we see here that shortly after patenting of these chemicals in 1964 and 1957, this is indicated by the arrows, we can immediately see these chemicals in the sediment. Now remember, these cores were taken in the mid-90s, but the chemicals were used in the late 50s and early 60s. So the chemicals your grandparents used back then are still awaiting degradation. And now we are ramping up the consumption of these chemicals. So clearly that wasn't a great idea. Now interestingly, in the 70s we see a peak of these chemicals and amazing concentrations for triclocarban. We see over 20 parts per million. That is a huge amount of chemical. This is visible by the naked eye. And so these concentrations are large. The chemicals are still there, having been deposited 30 or 40 years ago. But then the concentrations decline. What happened? Well, we had the Clean Water Act implemented, and we upgraded our wastewater treatment systems to include biological treatment. If you give the chemical a choice to either swim in the water or to hug a biological organism that is full of carbon and lipid, the chemical will tend to go to the lipids and to the carbon. And so what we've been doing since the 1970s is diverting the problem from the water environment to the terrestrial environment. Okay? And so we wanted to get a handle on this, and we collaborated with the US EPA to get representative biosolids, that is municipal sludge samples, from across the United States. We looked at 72 different chemicals and used the best techniques that are in the certified laboratory to make sure that our data are trustworthy. And look what we found. So after screening the biosolids for 72 different pharmaceuticals and personal care products, we found at the top of the heap the chemical that nobody knew what happened to it in 2002. So 8 years later now, it's the leading chemical accumulating in sewage sludge, making up, you know, tens of parts per million across the nation. Next up is triclosan. So 2 antimicrobials leading the pack here. But then ciprofloxacin, ofloxacin, and other antibiotics come up next. So you see the importance here. We are creating and sequestering large parts of the antimicrobial mass that is being produced and applied in agriculture, where it is in contact with our soils and the food that we eat. That is certainly not a good idea. To put this another way, is if you look at the EPA method on the left here, EPA method 1694, you can see that it monitors 72 different chemicals. Only 2 of those are antimicrobials as opposed to antibiotics. And but these 2 chemicals, triclosan and triclocarban, make up 2/3 of the mass of all 72 pharmaceuticals and personal care products combined. Now, another interesting aspect is that these chemicals don't work. The chemicals that are being added to antimicrobial soap are not effective. There are no clinical studies that convincingly show that they do any good. All it is we add these chemicals, have great marketing, and sell certain products and contaminate the environment, but there is no benefit to it. And this has been shown by the Food and Drug Administration Special Committee in 2005. So this is a no-brainer here. If you have two chemicals that only pose risk and that don't give us any benefit, removing them should be a natural action, right? That's what your mother would tell you. But unfortunately, we don't make common sense decisions anymore. We have very complicated mechanisms of assessing risk, and we assess only the risks that we know exactly, and then we parameterize them in ways that doesn't allow us to make very simple decisions that can save lives. So this is an example here. It translates, if you do the math, to about 400,000 plus minus 100,000 pounds of antimicrobials that go every day or every year in America from our households to agricultural land. And it presents a pathway for contamination of food with antimicrobials and drug-resistant microbes. Other things happen too. These chemicals are so abundant that I can swipe my finger here, and house dust can contain up to 2 parts per million of triclosan and triclocarbon. The chemical is present in every other stream that you walk up in the United States. And it bioaccumulates. It's present in 97% of breast milk sample of American women. So the first meal that the children get when they get born is a dose of triclosan. They contaminate fish and accumulate there. Even dolphins, they are found, because dolphins accumulate them in their fat. And so the parts per trillion levels that we have in coastal waters get concentrated up in the animal to detectable levels. And there's other implications that I can't elaborate on right now, such as endocrine disruption, behavioral changes, immunotoxicity, and so forth. The list of adverse outcomes is continuously increasing. So how is it that these chemicals don't work, and how is it that we have efficacy claims that say that these things are antimicrobial? Let me tell you that soap is antimicrobial by itself because it destroys membranes. These chemicals are toxic to microorganisms, but in order to be effective, you have to have a certain contact time. The contact time of general hand washing, on average, is 5 to 10 seconds. That's short, but that is what we actually do. You can show efficacy if you wash your hands for 2 or 5 minutes, but who has the time to go through a song twice, you know, when they wash their hands? That's really not happening. So that is why these chemicals don't work. Now, but consider now the recipients of this chemistry in the aquatic environment. Here we have a lifetime exposure. It's not on the order of 5 or 10 seconds. Indeed, these chemicals in these aquatic living organisms get exposed to the chemicals. They don't know a world that is not contaminated with antimicrobial compounds. And so they are also very sensitive to these types of compounds. We published a paper in 2009 that kind of juxtaposes the concentrations that we have reported in the environment with the toxic threshold values for different organisms that are susceptible to antimicrobials. And you see here that the concentration range goes from nanograms per liter or kilogram, that's parts per trillion, all the way to parts per million. And I showed you the sediment data and the biosolids data where concentrations are highest. Let's contrast this with the threshold values at which the chemicals are harmful to biota. And what you see here is that antimicrobials really are not antimicrobials. Antimicrobials are fish-killing agent, crustacean-killing agent, and algae-killing agent first. Microorganisms are fairly resistant to these types of chemicals. As you can see, the threshold concentrations for microbes are much higher than those for algae, crustaceans, and fish. And if you compare these concentrations, you can see that there is an overlap between the concentrations we know presently exist in the U.S. environment and those that are harmful for organisms and prevent their growth. For example, certain algae cannot live in surface waters in the U.S. anymore because concentrations are exceeded, so they can't tolerate them. Other examples are crustaceans in sediment pore water and microorganisms living in biosolids. So I already told you about bioaccumulation. So these chemicals have thoroughly penetrated our lifestyle and our chemosphere and biosphere. So you can find them almost everywhere. And so every second sample of cord blood being sampled already has detectable levels of triclosan And again, 97% of US women have detectable concentrations of triclosan in their breast milk. That's certainly information that we don't hear from the millions of dollars that are spent in marketing. But if people would know this, I think our consumption behavior would be very different. Now, let's take a look at the regulation. How is it that something that is a no-brainer for a person off the street cannot be regulated by agencies? Well, we have multiple agencies chiming in on this, and that's always a problem. It would be easier if one agency would be the point person. But we have the FDA, we have the EPA contributing to this. And so the FDA has tried to finalize the monograph on the use of these types of substances since 1974. And today, 37 years later, we still have not agreed on the final monograph. And so in 2005, I sat on this committee that was meant to finalize it. And now 6 years later, nothing has happened. And earlier this year, we had a congressional briefing where we summarized the new information. And it has only gotten worse in terms of all the risks that we learned about. Again, in summary, the main issues are cross-resistance to clinically important antibiotics. If you expose an E. coli to triclosan, it becomes less resistant. It becomes more resistant and less susceptible to 7 out of 11 tested antibiotics. And endocrine disruption is another issue. So in summary, don't believe the marketing. It's impossible to sterilize our homes. It's impossible to sterilize our bodies. There's no, even if we could, we wouldn't do it, because without the microbes, we wouldn't be able to digest our food and have healthy skin and so forth. So this is all fiction. What we do know is that we need proper hygiene, that hand washing is very important, but regular soap and water do, and you don't need to contaminate the environment for decades and generations in order to keep yourself clean. Most antimicrobial products are ineffective for non-clinical use, and it's not just what I say, but that's what all the experts say. So for some reason, nobody is listening to them anymore. Unwarranted use of antimicrobial products can pose risks to humans and the environment. So in conclusions, there's multiple points that I'd like to make. I don't want to read them all off, but I'd like to remind you, and maybe you can ask your congressional representative, how it is that a chemical that only poses risk is allowed to be present in all kinds of products on the market today. And everybody is concerned about the health of our aquatic environments and fish. And we see that with a single movement of taking these two chemicals out of the out of commerce, we could reduce the total burden of pharmaceuticals and personal care products in the United States by 2/3. That is a big change, and it would come at no cost. No jobs would be lost through this, because we would still use soap. And the chemicals actually come from Germany now, so, you know, and they're produced in China. Actually, we don't buy Chinese triclosan because that's too high in dioxins, so it's being taken from Germany. But so that's the message I want to leave you with. So there's multiple issues, as Ellen Silbergeld explained. There's the whole, you know, challenging issue of livestock, and then we have our own behavior to blame and a lack of regulatory action. With this, I'd like to thank the agencies that have supported this, particularly the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, an unnamed donor who has supported me over the years, and the US EPA and many other agencies, including the USGS. Thank you very much.